So being super clear about what your non-negotiables are and what your negotiables are. So I make sure that anybody you hire into my organization, no matter at what level, you share those values with me. What I found is that if you compromise on the things that you care about, right, you know, as part of your core principles, those relationships don't go very long.
Hey everyone, and welcome to Keep Moving Forward, the podcast from X Team for tech professionals who are passionate about growth, leadership, and innovation. I'm your host, Caleb Brown, and in each episode, we dive into candid conversations with the tech industry's brightest minds, seasoned leaders, forward-thinking engineers, and visionary experts. Today, I'm joined by Suresh Tekchandani, Vice President of Product and Engineering at Ancestry. Suresh has built a career at the intersection of engineering and product, leading teams through transformation while keeping them grounded in clarity and focus. In this episode, Suresh shares how to scale engineering organizations without losing sight of fundamentals. We talk about balancing innovation with operational discipline, creating alignment across product and engineering, and why prioritization is one of the most important leadership skills. He also explains how trust and transparency fuel collaboration across teams and why growth is about focus, not just doing more. If your leading technical teams are looking to make your own leadership more impactful, this conversation is full of practical insight. Let's get started. Thank you so much for joining me. Obviously, I've been able to, you know, to check out your background, to check out your experience, and you've done a ton. You have an impressive background, and I'm super excited to dive in today.
Yeah, good to be here, Caleb. Thanks for inviting me to your show.
100%. I appreciate you being here. And so, yeah, maybe I think the best way to kick things off, like I said, I have been lucky enough to have a sneak peek into your experience and your background, but maybe we could kick things off with having you kind of walk us through your career journey, starting all the way back in the early days in India into your current role at Ancestry.
Sure. So to start off, my name is Suresh Tekchandani. And just a quick intro about myself, I'm a technology leader who helps companies build and operate large-scale customer-facing SaaS products and services, technology platforms, and a cloud infrastructure so that they can deliver the value that they want to deliver for their customers and grow their business. I've been in Silicon Valley for 25 years now. Started off my career back in the late 90s with a startup company called Intertest Technologies. They operated in DRM space, which stands for digital rights management. Went through dot-com boom and bust cycle, like many of us did at the time. Landed at eBay after that. Worked there for a few years. Then I worked for PayPal for some time. Then spent some time at Intuit before I landed at my current company, which is Ancestry. I lead their platform team, which is comprised of e-commerce, MarTech stack, and a lot of infrastructure in the backend, such as CRM systems, experimentation platform, chatbots, and things of that nature. Prior to coming to US, I worked for an Indian outsourcing company called Infosys Technologies in Bangalore. I spent a few years there. And prior to that, I did my undergrad from IIT BHU.
Nice. Very cool. So, you know, again, by looking back at your background and then hearing a little bit about your journey, what would you say is the biggest challenge from transitioning from, you know, kind of a hands-on individual contributor developer for 12, 13 years before, you know, becoming a technology leader? So what was that biggest challenge from that transition from, you know, developer writing code into a tech leader?
So I would say the journey for me has been very natural, going from a heads-down programmer, which is something that I always enjoyed doing. I built software, I wrote software for the longest time, like 12, 13, 14 years of my career. And that is all I wanted to do. I never opted or applied for an engineering management or leadership position. But I was at a company, as I mentioned earlier during my intro, I worked for PayPal for a few years, and the company was going through a steep growth phase at the time. And I just happened to be at the right place in the organization where they were looking to have leaders who can lead you know, an engineering team. And I was trusted with that responsibility. And, you know, I started kind of work as a tech lead for that team and sort of slowly started to take more people responsibilities. And I would say I was surrounded with some great leaders there. I learned a ton just by, you know, seeing them from a distance, how they carried themselves, how they carried conversations, how they worked with other leaders across the company. And that sort of paved the way for me to, you know, the leadership roles that I held later on in my career.
Yeah, absolutely. That makes sense. You had mentioned a couple of places you've worked with. So, you know, major tech companies, eBay, we just talked about PayPal, Intuit, Ancestry now. How has moving through these kind of different environments influenced your leadership style throughout the years?
The one quality or, you know, a characteristic that has really helped me is keeping an open mindset towards learning. So I've always viewed my job as a learning experience. So I've never walked into a job or into a role into an organization thinking that, hey, I know everything. I know the best, right? And that has never been the case. I've always looked up to others to see, even if there were people who were working for me or, you know, reporting to me, I've always kind of took the time to understand where they were coming from, what they knew about the system, about the product, because they were there before me. So certainly, you know, it takes time to, you know, ramp up and understand where they were coming from and what are the key challenges that they were facing, who a customer was, like I mentioned before, right? You know, everything starts with the customer. So taking the time to understand the landscape is extremely critical for you to be successful as a leader in any organization. And that, I think, one quality I would say has helped me a lot over the years. I have worked at Intuit as an ops leader, engineering operations leader. I had no background in that role. So I learned a lot of that on the job. Before that, I was with PayPal, where I, you know, oversaw the development of payments platform and many other products that we serve to our customers in the SMB space. So in my current role, you know, we are a direct-to-consumer business where we build experiences that we present to our customers, and it requires different kind of mindset and knowing what their challenges are and where the friction points may be, going and resolving those. But I would say that kind of one quality has always served me well, is just keeping the open mindset and learning the most from the job.
Absolutely. That's a very good takeaway. You know, there are plenty of developers as well as, you know, developing engineers and managers that tune in and listen. It's always, you know, I try to ask those kinds of questions because I think it's helpful to hear those things and, you know, just kind of approach. And I think so. Yeah, I think approaching things with an open mind is certainly the best way to do it. On our kind of intro call or prep call, I believe it was, that you mentioned the importance of moving beyond prescriptive leadership and creating frameworks that, you know, best practices become, you know, default behavior. I thought that was fascinating. I wanted to see if you could elaborate a little bit on how you've really implemented that approach.
Yeah, I think every leader leaves their mark in the organization, right? Everybody has their sort of own style, how they want to lead, how they work with folks they are surrounded with. In most cases, you join a company, you already have a team, right? You don't have the luxury to build a team that, you know, you call dream team, right? And you want to build from ground up. In some cases you do, but in most cases you have already a team in place that you have to lead or work with. So it's important for you to make sure that you speak openly about your core principles, right? What is your, you know, thinking around either if you're building software or you're trying to run an ops team or whatever your job function may be. But it's important to speak openly about your leadership principles, right? So for me, it's always been about the end customers, right? You're having the customer focus has been important to me. And if you talk to any of my team members, they will tell you the same thing. I drive results through innovation and disciplined execution. Continuous learning is important to me. And investing in people, like I said before, right? Making sure that you understand the organizational dynamics, the people who you are working with, what their ambitions are, what their strengths are, what their weaknesses are, and working with them every day in the job to make sure that they are growing, right? You're giving them, you know, projects that align with their long-term growth aspirations, right? And last but not the least, always looking for ways, you know, to optimize things and doing more with less, something that I have always embraced as a principle, optimizing our footprint on cloud or just the, you know, how we have designed our organizations, the functions that I defined in my organization over the years. So I think those sort of, you know, how I have always led my teams.
Very interesting. And actually, I want to talk a little bit more about kind of building those teams. For your approach for hiring for your teams, what key characteristics or qualities are you looking for? And that's, of course, I'm talking, you know, beyond the technical skills.
So being super clear about what your non-negotiables are and what your negotiables are, right? I think that has been super clear, so super critical for me to build the right teams. And non-negotiables for me have been, you know, the code quality, delivering value to the customers, defining what those KPIs are, right? You could not come to me and negotiate, hey, can I launch this feature with like 15 defects, right? Or, you know, it can cause breakages or the performance is subpar, right? So those things are non-negotiable, right? I would not engage, right? It's just something that you have to have, right? So I make sure that anybody I hire into my organization, no matter at what level, you share those values with me. So making sure that you're super clear about your non-negotiables, right? And then you can come to an agreement on, you know, the personalities and how you work with people, what their preferences are. You work remotely in the office or their kind of styles and things like that. I think those things certainly can be discussed, the timelines of the projects, like depending on the complexities and the design considerations, like can we make this trade-off, that trade-off, those things we can work through. But what I found is that if you compromise on the things that you care about, right, you know, as part of your core principles, those relationships don't go very long.
Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. Just prior, a question or two ago, you had mentioned that you do typically inherit teams, but you have both led teams that were inherited as well as built them from scratch. So I was interested in your strategies, I guess, for each scenario to create high performing, you know, engineering organizations. And I'm just curious how your approaches are different, whether it is an inherited team versus one from scratch, and you know, just how you, at the end of the day, make sure that team is high performing engineers.
Yeah, absolutely. So I would say, you know, if you're fortunate enough to build the team from scratch, then I think it makes your job much easier, right? You can hire the people with the right skills, hard skills, soft skills, right? Those who align with your company culture, your business objectives, you know, things of that nature. But more often, like the job that we do, you already have a team in place, like you said. In most cases, at least in my experience, I've not had much resistance. You know, I've never had anybody saying, oh, I don't want to do, you know, load testing. I don't want to do performance testing. I don't want to do unit testing, right? Most people want to do it, right? It's just that they need more clarity from the leaders as to what we expect of them. And, you know, there sometimes can be people who maybe are not as passionate about some of these values, right, that we're discussing here. And in those cases, you know, I offer them opportunities to work, you know, elsewhere in the organization if those things align better with their ambitions and what they want to do in their careers. I'm fairly open about those conversations. And these are important conversations to be had as a leader, because it does nobody no good if you have, you know, misalignment right within your organization. So yeah, that's been sort of my approach.
Yeah. I mean, that's excellent to hear. You know, I think any of that support that someone could give for someone who is, you know, misaligned, they're an amazing worker, I'm sure, but you know, in the wrong spot, and support for finding the right spot for them is, you don't always see that. Luckily, a lot of times you do, but you don't always see it. So it's a nice thing to hear happening. You've worked at organizations where I think this is just a really, it would be an interesting window to look into. I'm curious how you balance the need for innovation, so staying, you know, on the top, really, in terms of competitors and things like that. So how you balance innovating, building new things, with maintaining the stability of the existing platform that the business depends on. Always curious how folks kind of manage that and foresee it even when kind of planning. And so, you know, so curious if you have some insights there.
Yeah, so I think my view on innovation is very simple. You know, I think innovation can occur even in when you're trying to maintain a piece of software that has already been written, right? Innovation can occur, like, you know, at the, you know, at the level of the product where, you know, you're creating new experiences for your customers, or it could be how you even do your operations, how you do security patches and upkeep, maintenance, and things like that. You can come up with, like, you know, really creative ways to solve a maintenance problem, for example. That's innovation in my books, right? Of course, right? If you can find a more economical, better way, more efficient way to accomplishing a task, you've done innovation in my books. So what I talk to my team about is how can you use these new tools, right? This new frameworks that are launching almost every week or every month now, right? With AI, all the advancements that are taking place. I mean, how can we leverage the innovation that's happening outside of our four walls to drive innovation within our organization? But the innovation can come from within the organization in terms of how you solve complex problems and allows you to scale up fast, right? So that's sort of my view. And I've had a lot of success, you know, in my current organization. We are starting to use a lot of these AI tools. And it's less about, you know, what new feature we can develop for the customers. Of course, that's something that we have teams thinking about. But from purely engineering perspective, since this is an engineering conversation, I have tried to sort of inspire and encourage people to view these tools and frameworks as a means to bring more efficiencies. We have the tools now, the large language models that we have available today. These were like not known like 4 or 5 years ago. So I think there is a, you know, a huge room for growth, right, for these organizations to start to use these tools that can solve some of the long-standing problems that actually require a lot of manual effort, right? And those cycles could be used to deliver more customer-facing features, right? Or could be, you know, used better, right? Same investment could yield better results if you were not to sort of spend as much time maintaining and just keeping up with your, you know, operational work. That makes sense.
Absolutely does. Yeah, no, that's well said. That's a good way to look at it. On this podcast, I make sure that I talk at least to some degree about managing kind of global and remote teams. It's something we, you know, even post-COVID, still hear a ton about, you know, some organizations thriving with it and some not doing as well and just still trying to kind of figure it out. I'm curious what specific challenges you've faced when managing these globally distributed engineering teams and kind of how you've addressed that over the years and things have kind of looked for you in that department.
Yeah, so I've managed global teams for a long time. It's been at least 10, 15 years now. I don't even remember when I started doing that, but it's the stark difference between those teams that actually struggle and the teams that have gotten so much value, right, out of their remote teams. And the key difference, Caleb, that I've seen is, of course, apart from the hard skills, right, and finding the right people, right, and that goes without saying. So making sure that there is enough collaboration happening no matter where the teams are situated, right? The more FaceTime, the better. I know it's hard for people here to have phone calls every night and just, you know, because the time difference, right? It's hard to do. It's not easy, which is why you see some teams or some folks kind of shy away from that. It's not their fault. It's just very demanding on your personal life to spend like a couple of hours every night or early morning, right, on remote teams. But if you do that, you see amazing outcomes. To see teams more engaged, they deliver more value, as I mentioned earlier. And I've had experiences where my remote team actually operated much better in some cases than the team here. It's just for some reason, it's just, you know, that team really, you know, took that to the heart. It's like, I want to make it work, you know, leadership cares. I would show up every 2-3 months and we would go out, talk to them, you know, at a more personal level. So they feel more engaged And that is when you see amazing outcomes from these remote teams.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. So the company I work for, X Team, fully remote, always has been. But, and when we do the morning calls for some of us and evening calls for others, but just what, a week or two ago, the whole kind of core team met up in Hawaii for a few days. And not only was it nice to be in Hawaii, but the energy of seeing folks and getting dinner, having drinks, hanging out was, you know, the amount of like business related conversations that came from that. And just now that we're all back home and working, the amount of, you know, ideas and things we were talking about then that we followed through on or now acting on is just, it's really energizing. So you can always, you can do it 100% remote. But yeah, if you have the, if it makes sense for the team, this team size, I know a really large team can be tricky, but for us to get together even once a year, truly, I mean, noticeable changes. Yeah. Yeah. Actually, so that is, it's fascinating. I wanted to move on a little bit and talk about kind of tech strategy of innovation. At Ancestry, you're responsible for e-commerce and in the marketing tech systems that deliver, you know, super personalized customer experiences. And you talked about AI briefly earlier. I'm curious how you approach integrating AI and machine learning into these platforms.
Yeah. So look, at Ancestry, we've had, you know, AI before most people even knew that, right? So, you know, we are a business that offer, you know, a product that's deeply personal to people. You know, we allow people, bring people onto our platform to create their family trees. We send them hints. We've had this business for a long time. And some of these capabilities that are now labeled as AI have existed. Of course, the technology has changed, has evolved, and things have gotten better on that front. With the advent of these large language models, things have gotten more streamlined, structured on how we find these matches and deliver that to our customers. So we've been on this journey for a long time. And now, of course, you know, we're seeing the new tools becoming available in the marketplace that are allowing our customers to perform these tasks, right, as you call them, more efficiently. But also it allows us to, you know, do more innovation and bring more features to our customers so that they can benefit from all these technology innovation that's happening in the AI space to do the same task, maybe in a more efficient manner, but also perform new, you know, tasks that weren't doable before, right? So we have had pretty good success with lots of new features that we rolled out to the customers, but also we are using a lot of the AI tools to, like I said before, to improve the operations, how we operate as a company, and bringing more efficiency in how we build software, and like most tech companies out there.
It's a wild time. Like you said, you know, there's something AI related that's, you know, significant. Truly feels like daily. It's fun to see different organizations, different companies that have, that solve different problems and they have different problems, you know, implement these things in a way that, like you said earlier, you know, 5 years ago, that wasn't even, you know, there was machine learning and things like that, of course, but the very current landscape is pretty interesting. Wanted to talk a little broader, a question I always find fascinating. How do you kind of evaluate when to build a custom solution versus leveraging third-party services?
Caleb, that's a hard question to answer.
It is a hard question to answer.
And the reason is it depends on the context, right? It depends on what you're looking at, right? So the rule of thumb that I use is that if something is, you know, core to the company's business, for example, right? Something that, you know, a company is going to benefit from usually by, you know, building it in-house so that we can add new features to it and answer to our needs. And it's going to be very hard for us to customize things, right, that we buy off the shelf, right? And take all those things into consideration. I would say that's a starting point. But beyond that, you know, you have to assess how complex of an undertaking that will be, right? And if you feel in your judgment, that's something for the company to pay for, right? If you want to build in-house versus buying something off the shelf. And I've done both over the years, as you would imagine. So there are systems that we've purchased from outside that work, you know, well with some customizations and things like that. And things like CRM, right? You're not going to build a customer relationship management platform, right? It was just not our core strength. So we buy it off the shelf, customer data platform, for example. There were ideas on like building it in-house versus, you know, buying software. We said, oh, you know, it's not our core strength, so we'll rather buy from outside, and that's worked well. And there are things like, you know, our e-commerce workflows, right, that we are, you know, continuing to scale up, right, to other geos and locales. It's much easier, in my opinion, to have that done in-house. And all the incremental changes that we've been making to the software over the years, so that's more aligned to the company strategy, where we've been, you know, driving our customers. It's certainly more beneficial for us to do in-house. So I think it's some of those considerations that you have to, you know, give to this topic and make sure that you're making the right decisions. And, you know, sometimes you make mistakes and, you know, you sort of learn from that and then go back and fix it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, that makes sense. As we've talked about, and especially, you know, we're kind of wrapping up here. So I do like to have the last few questions be a little, you know, kind of future outlooky, you know, looking into the future. And as we said, you've witnessed the evolution of, you know, Web 1.0 all the way to kind of today's AI-driven landscape. What technology trends do you think will be most, you know, significantly impact engineering leadership in the next 5 years, given everything you've seen and now the kind of the AI world that we're in now?
Yeah, so I mean, AI is here to stay. I think that is probably one of the biggest shift, you know, that we've seen in the technology landscape, at least in my, you know, experience in the industry. So I think we are at the early stages of that. We are still kind of assessing what can be accomplished with AI versus, you know, something that requires more human intervention. I think the landscape is going to be fundamentally different in a few short years, you know. So as we sort of peel the onion, right, on that one and understand, right, the power of Gen AI, right, what it's capable of, we also have to make sure that we are using it in a way that it's not going to be harmful, right, to our customers and the mankind, right? You know, with more flexibility comes more responsibility, right? Something that we all know and, you know, got to make sure that it's reflected in our strategy as we adopt these tools. But I would say we've had good success, you know, in the early adoption of that, as I'm seeing it, you know, in the company. And not just my company, but I have folks who work at other companies and I've pretty much like, you know, heard the same thing from them. The technology has a lot of, you know, upside to it, but there's also things that we have to manage, right? You know, the error rates and just, you know, presenting false information to the customers, right? Or, you know, users out there that could be very damaging to the company's brand. And, you know, ultimately it can also hurt customers. So making sure that we walk into this with eyes wide open, and, you know, taking steps to ensure that none of those things happen, right? Or if they do happen, you have protocol in place and procedures in place to be able to sort of revert and course correct, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, no, very well said. And so, yeah, we'll wrap on my final question here. And I do usually like to end the podcast with a question like this. If you could sort of wave a magic wand, if you will, and change one thing that would positively impact technology leadership culture across the industry, what would you do? What would you use your magic wand on?
At a super high level, I would say sharing that view or that understanding that technology exists to solve a specific real world problem, I think will certainly be helpful to make sure that the technology investments are going to the right place. And if certain investment is not producing the desired outcome, you'll be quick to roll back or sort of course correct or, you know, not keep going in because, you know, it's not going to yield any good results, right, for the business or the company, right? So, yeah, I would say that's kind of one aspect that I've not heard people talk about enough. People get real excited about a piece of technology and before you know it, they spend years and millions of dollars. And there's not much to show other than some excitement that you get along the way. I mean, look, don't get me wrong. I'm an engineer by profession. You know, that's what I've done all my life. You know, I love engineering solutions. I've enjoyed writing code and building, you know, customer facing products, like I said before, but ultimately, you know, it is there to serve a specific need and you should keep that, you know, at the forefront, knowing your customer and making sure that you're delivering value to the business. And that is what will make you successful. That'll make your business successful.
Incredibly well said. Well, like I said, that was the last question. So Suresh, thank you so much for joining me today. This was a lot of fun. I learned a lot. It was cool to, you know, to go through your history, your career, and learn a bit from it. So thank you so much.
You're welcome, Caleb. And thanks for having me on your show. Appreciate it.
That was a thoughtful conversation with Suresh on what it takes to scale both teams and impact as a technology leader. One thing that stood out to me was his focus on clarity, making sure people know what matters most and why. His approach to prioritization, cutting through the noise, and keeping teams aligned on outcomes is a powerful reminder that less can often be more. I also found his perspective on building trust across product and engineering especially valuable. He's not just talking about process or ceremonies. He's talking about creating an environment where people feel ownership, accountability, and support to do their best work. Thank you, Suresh, for sharing your journey and lessons on how to lead with focus, balance, innovation with scale, and keep teams connected to purpose. Join us next time for more insightful conversations with tech leaders who inspire us to grow, lead, and innovate. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube Music, and don't forget to share this episode if it resonated with you. Until next time.